Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, Joseph Stiglitz returns with part two of a fine talk on our growing economic inequality. It's bad for the people, it's bad for the economy, and the 1% are trying very hard to make the problem even worse. I hope you'll stay tuned. Economist Joseph Stiglitz is a card-carrying member of the establishment, but the liberal wing of the establishment. I think that, like Franklin Roosevelt, he's trying to save capitalism from itself, not trying to overthrow it. Okay, fair enough. What he offers is a brilliant analysis of exactly what is going wrong with the economy, what is causing it to go wrong, and who is benefiting from the sufferings of so many others. The last question is an easy one. Stiglitz himself says, we have an economic system, quote, of the 1%, by the 1%, and for the 1%, unquote. Michael Parenti, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and others have been saying words like this for years. But it's bracing to hear the same also from a distinguished mainstream source. Stiglitz's resume includes stints as the chairman of the President's Council on Economic Advisers, as chief economist of the World Bank, as recipient of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Science. When he says the system is nuts, it really is nuts. And he explains the problems very well indeed. This is an archival recording. Stiglitz spoke in 2012. I've cut out a number of stumbles and hesitations, but apart from that, not a word needed to be changed. Today, we'll hear the conclusion of Stiglitz's talk, and then a selection from the Q&A that followed. The title of the presentation is How Inequality in Today's Society Endangers Our Future. Joseph Stiglitz.
I want to spend just a few minutes trying to explain why America's inequality is so bad for our economy and our growth. It's bad for our politics. It has a lot of adverse effects. But in the narrow sense, you know, not looking at this from a moral point of view, just looking at it from an economic point of view, it's bad. The first reason is that this kind of inequality is associated with more instability and a weaker economy. It's not an accident that the last time inequality reached a level that is comparable to what we have today was in 1929, right before the Great Depression. And the reason for this, let me try to explain it very quickly. The people at the top save a significant fraction of their income, 15, 20%. The people at the bottom can't. They spend all their money. So when you redistribute money from the bottom to the top, you reduce demand. Now, the response of the Fed ignored what was going on and said, oh, I know how to keep demand going. Let's create a bubble. Now, of course, they didn't say it quite that way. What they did is they got rid of regulations, they had a flood of liquidity, and that did create the bubble. And it kept the economy going in spite of the fact of the low demand that was arising from the growing inequality. It worked, but only temporarily. And that was predictable, and it was predicted. And of course, now we're dealing with the aftermath. But part of that aftermath is that we still have the degree of inequality, but we don't have the bubble. And that means that our economy is lacking effective demand, aggregate demand, and that means there's going to be high levels of unemployment persistently. Some of the other reasons that inequality is bad for our economy and for economic growth follow very much from the analysis of the sources of inequality. You know, I talked about one of the sources of inequality is the extensive rent-seeking. And as I said, the nature of rank seeking is that you're trying to get more money from others rather than adding to the wealth of the society. And so you're diverting resources to speculation, to lobbying, to try to persuade Congress to give you a gift, rather than using it more productively. In fact, I mean, one as a teacher at Columbia, and all when I talk to teachers at other universities, they feel this frustration. Their best students disproportionately went into finance. You know, in the older days, they would have gone into research and to public service and to medicine, into a whole variety of professions. But because of the magnitude of the lure of the money in investment banking, they disproportionately went into that area. And if a society is allocating all of its human capital in that area, there are going to be consequences. A third reason why, on average, societies with higher level of inequality don't do very well relates to the phenomenon I described before, that America is the country with the least equality of opportunity. Now, what does that mean? That means people at the bottom are not living up to their potential. Their life prospects depend on their education, depends on the education and income of their parents. And that means a large fraction of Americans are not living up to their potential, and that obviously is weakening the economy. The final thing is, a strong economy requires heavy levels of public investment. Public investment in infrastructure, technology, education. But when you have a very divided society, it's very difficult to get support for that kind of public investment. Part of the reason is that the 1%, the people at the top, worry about too strong of a government, because they worry that the government might use its powers to redistribute, and they don't want that. They don't need the public parks. They don't need the public education. And so, for them, government is a threat. And yet, in the long run, they're wrong. Because unless you would make these investments, the overall economy is not going to perform well, and they won't do well. So there's one really important idea that comes out of this analysis, and that is, if you look at the old textbooks, they always talk about trade-offs. Yes, inequality is a bad thing, they say, but to get less inequality will pay a price. The price we'll pay is lower growth, lower GDP. Okay, that's the story. So yes, there are trade-offs, and if you want more equality, you have to pay a price. What this analysis says, that we can have more equality and more growth, a more efficient economy. There's not a trade-off. In fact, this inequality is really hurting our economy. That's the reason for the title, The Price of Inequality. Well, I've described the effects on our economy. I want to say a little bit about other aspects of our society, because I do think that the level of inequality that we've achieved is weakening our democracy. And there's a fundamental puzzle here. Those of you who've studied political science know that the standard theory says that in a democracy, the outcomes should reflect the median voter, the person that half want more public spending, half want less. If you look at what's the outcome of America democracy, it doesn't reflect the median. It's much closer to reflecting the views at the top. And that's a puzzle. And I try to analyze why that is. And two hypotheses. One of them is that there's been a process of disenfranchisement. We saw that in Florida. Disempowerment and, most importantly, disillusionment. Because if you have a politics that leads to outcomes that are the same no matter what happens, that is to say, the elite drive the legislation, no matter what party, it may make some difference, but they say, well, it doesn't make a lot of difference. And you get a disillusionment with Democratic politics. And you saw that so clearly in the last election in 2010, where only 20% of the young people bothered to show up. And what they were saying is, politics isn't going to solve the problem. And that, I think, is extraordinarily bad for our democracy. The other partial reason for what's been going on has to do with advances in modern psychology, behavioral economics, marketing. Firms have learned how to sell products. For instance, they were able to sell the idea that there was no credible evidence that cigarettes caused cancer, even though the cigarette companies had in their files the evidence that it did cause cancer. But they said this over and over again. They had a good advertising campaign, and an awful lot of people believed it. The point here is, if you can sell bad, dangerous products, you can also sell bad ideas. And those in the 1% have the tools today, the modern tools, they have the resources, they have the incentives to do exactly that. And you see that over and over again. Perceptions of the degree of inequality in the United States have been shaped by those who don't want Americans to realize how unequal we are. Equality of opportunity. You know, people say, well, we don't care about equality of outcome, we care about equality of opportunity, as if that's what we have, but we don't. So there's been a concerted effort to convince America that there isn't a problem when there clearly is. Well, what I try to do in a series of chapters in the book is to show how the growing inequality affects every aspect of our society, of our politics. So just let me give two examples. We're used to thinking of our country as determined by a rule of law, justice for all. But what do you mean by a rule of law and justice for all? A rule of law is supposed to protect those at the bottom. Just to give you one example, think about what happened in the foreclosure crisis. We threw people out of their homes under the so-called rule of law who owed nothing. And of course, what is the bank's response? Well, their response is, well, most of the people who were thrown out of their homes did owe something. But a system of justice that says most of the people who get capital punishment were probably guilty is something that we should feel uncomfortable with. But that is the mindset of the banks. We've really undermined the rule of law. And if you look at other aspects of our system of justice, what we've evolved to is not justice for all, but justice for those who can afford it. As another example, in Washington, you're going through the battle of the budget. You might actually think that the battle of the budget was about the deficit, but it's not. It's about this issue of inequality. If it were about the deficit, the first place you begin is to remember 10 years ago, we had a surplus. We had a surplus that was so large that Alan Greenspan said that unless we do something about it, we are going to pay back our total national debt, and he would not be able to conduct monetary policy. Now, when you think about it for a moment, you realize how specious that argument was. Assume, in fact, that those surpluses had continued, and in, say, 2015, we had almost paid back the national debt. I believe that he could have gone, or his successor could have gone to Congress and said, we face a national emergency. You have to spend more, and you have to have a deficit. I cannot believe that Congress and the administration couldn't figure out a way of spending more and getting the deficit up. And yet he made, with a straight face, that argument, and Congress passed a tax cut for the millionaires on the basis of that argument. Well, you go through the other things that happened between 2001 and today, and you realize, of course, that we converted this surplus into a very big deficit. And the obvious way to get rid of the deficit is to reverse what the four things, there are only four things that really led the change of our fiscal position between 2001 and 2011. That would go at least a very long way to correcting the deficit problem. But that kind of discussion is not on the agenda at all. What are they talking about? In a deficit reduction package that comes from Bowles Simpson, they talk about capping the tax rate at the top. So really what is here is an agenda to reduce the degree to some extent. I don't want to make it too strong, but there is at least an element here of reducing the degree of distribution, of progressivity in our economy, in our society. Well, the final chapter presents an agenda for reform, and you can see that it pretty well follows from the analysis of the sources of inequality of all all the kinds, the top, the middle, and the bottom. I won't go through it because I want to open it up for question. But there is a difficult question. While it's easy to write down the economic reform agenda, I had 21 points, but my editor said you can't list 21 points in a book that anybody will buy. So it's there, but you'll have to figure it out as 21 points. We know what the economics, we know what to do. The question is, where will politics allow it? And this is where, to get the economic reforms, we're going to have political reforms. And the political agenda, I think, is fairly well understood, although there's some aspects that I try to call attention to that haven't gotten sufficient attention. But campaign finance reform, stopping the revolving doors, the role of lobbyists, and so forth. The difficulty is we're in a vicious circle. More economic inequality leads to more political inequality that leads to rules that make for more economic inequality. And the question is, how do you cut into that vicious circle? Well, I don't have any magic solution to that. I wish I did. And so that leads me to the final question, is there hope? Now, I'm of two minds about this, but I want to end on a little bit of an upbeat, because I was also told that people don't buy books if they're going to get depressed. My book, The $3 Trillion War, it became a phrase, the $3 trillion war, but nobody wanted to buy it because it was too depressing. And it turned out to underestimate the cost of the war, and we can go into that later. So let me end on an optimistic note with a realization that there is some skepticism about this optimism. Our country has been at high levels of inequality in other times, in the Gilded Age, in the Roaring Twenties. And each of those times, we step back. We step back from the brink. In the Gilded Age, after the Gilded Age, we had the Progressive Era, where we passed antitrust laws to deal with monopoly, a whole set of legislation to make our society work better and more together. The New Deal, we know about the whole set of legislation in the 30s that made our economy work better and our society come together. So what I hope is that Americans will realize where we are, what the consequences are, what the price that we are paying for inequality, and what the price we will pay for inequality if we allow it to continue, that they'll step back from the brink and do something about what is clearly one of our most pressing problems. Thank you.
The stockholders had more control over CEO salaries until about 1980.
No, what basically happened was we didn't change our corporate governance laws, but there used to be a kind of social consensus, a kind of self-discipline that the CEO said, it is wrong for us to take a salary that's 1,000 times that of our average worker. You know, in Japan, the norm was 10. In Europe, it's, maybe 30. And the United States just went out of bounds. So you might call it the social contract disappeared in the United States. And then because we had no corporate governance laws like Australia had, there was nothing to restrain. And finally, the breaking of the air traffic control strike weakened unions, which had served as a partial constraint. And then we got in the situation where the company would say, we have to pay you low wages because we don't have the revenue. And the reason we don't have the revenue is because we're paying myself this $400 million salary. And they said that again with a straight face.
Do you have any ideas? I'll bet a few people here are stockholders of some companies.
There is a movement for shareholder activism, and what's really striking in Europe, it's actually working. People are voting down the exorbitant pay of a lot of CEOs. And the interesting thing is what they call exorbitant is minuscule compared to American exorbitant CEO pay.
Would you care to comment on the loss of manufacturing base in the United States, the rise of China, India, and other economies, as to what the impact is on the price of inequality?
The question is not easy to fully answer, the role of globalization in this whole process. Let me say that 30 years ago, we could have kept manufacturing more in the United States, but we decided to let it go. We decided not to have any industrial policy, as it's called, no strategy. And once you let it go, you start losing your what we call dynamic comparative advantage. You become less competitive. They learn, we don't learn. They develop institutions. You take a look, Germany, you mentioned Asia, but Germany maintained their industrial capacity, but they have good education oriented around it. They have a set of financial institutions. They have what they call the Mittelstand, a set of entrepreneurs that are focused on them. So they've managed to maintain it, but we've lost it, and it will be very difficult to recover. But let me also say, even if we were able to do a little bit in recovering, we have to realize that manufacturing is a little bit like agriculture 100 years ago. We are the victim of our own success. Increases in productivity in agriculture meant that we went from a world in which more than 60% of people were on farmers to a world where 2% of the population grows more food than even an obese population can consume. Manufacturing has been in the same light. You know, we've been increasing productivity, and the result of that, manufacturing jobs in China are going down dramatically. So we are getting a smaller share of a declining employment, and that's why we have to restructure our economy.
Well, I didn't get to read your things. When I was an economics major, you had not written your first book yet. I have one question, but it's a little bit involved. And it's not about inequality, but you're the right person to ask the question of. If economics is a science, why are there competing economic theories with different answers to the same questions? Or do the different theories have different economic goals? And if so, why and what are they? Or have the theories of Adam Smith, F.A. Hayek, and Milton Friedman been misrepresented to us by politicians with an agenda?
Well, it's a good question. Let me... The difficulty with economics is it should be a science, but economic analysis has political consequences. And that means there are strong incentives for formulating ideas that support your political perspectives. So let me try to give examples of what I'm talking about. In my own research on asymmetries of information, all that means is the information is imperfect. Some people know more, something that other people don't know. What we showed was that the reason that Adam Smith's invisible hand was invisible was that it wasn't there. That is to say that it was not the case that the pursuit of self-interest leads inexorably to the well-being of everybody. You know, the bankers pursued their self-interest, and I don't think any of us would say it led to the well-being of all of us. So that theory has been totally discredited as a theory. But if you listen to Milton Friedman and his disciples, you would not believe that there was this research that is taught in all the graduate schools, accepted everywhere, but they have a political agenda. They want to ignore these results. Now, of course, what they try to say is, oh, yes, this is a little peccadillo, you know, imperfect information, but we're almost with perfect information. And that was why when I did my research, one of the things I showed is that even a little bit of imperfect information changed the results in a dramatic way. There was a discontinuity. Again, they don't want to pay any attention to that. So my answer is the reason why you hear different theories to a large extent, not completely, is that there is a political agenda on some of these theories. Now, there are some other cases where there's ambiguous empirical evidence. You know, the world is complicated and we have to interpret the world. And let me give you an example very briefly of where there ought to be unanimity, but there is controversy, and I'll try to explain what. And that is, there's a big debate about the role of austerity. Now, there has not been a single large economy that has ever recovered through austerity. Not a single one. Now, those on the other side have identified a few instances where governments cut back and the economy grew. Those were all small economies. And if you look at what happened, it was very simple. They were lucky. They were lucky because their trading partners were going into a boom. And so as their government spending went down, the gap was more than filled by exports. So there are some circumstances, and you couldn't even manage it, you know, to increase your export if you're a small economy, especially if you have flexible exchange rates. But we're not a small economy, and our trading partners are really not in good shape. So there is no way that we can hope to grow through austerity. There is no way that Europe can hope to grow through austerity. There have been experiment after experiment, you might say, call it an experiment. They're real life experiments. The first one, recent history, of course, was Herbert Hoover. And he tried austerity, converted the stock market crash into the Great Depression. I don't know why anybody wants to try that again, but there are some Republicans who want to do that. But then, if we didn't have enough evidence, the IMF did some more experiments on some involuntary patients. And it had austerity in Indonesia, Korea, Thailand, Argentina. And in each of these instances, it was a disaster. Downturns were converted into recessions, recessions into depressions. Not one of them worked. So that's an instance where people can say, oh, yes, you haven't looked at the data. There are successes. But when you look at the data more carefully, you realize there are none.
So you need to speak to Paul Ryan.
I hope he listens.
We've been hearing part two of economist Joseph Stiglitz's fine talk, How Inequality in Today's Society Endangers Our Future. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. If you missed part of the talk, you can grab the whole thing and nearly all of our 8 years of broadcasts on the web. Our address is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust advising illegit to my non-carborundum. 99-1 is pretty good odds, and please come back again next week. Ciao.